Genesis 5:1-6:8, the eighth talk in a series on Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on April 9, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be starting at the very end of Genesis chapter 4, just the last two verses. Up to this point in Genesis, Moses has explained to us how evil first became manifest in mankind, that Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of which they had been told not to eat, so they acted in direct rebellion to one of God's, or to God's commandment. But what we saw last week in chapter 4 is that this evil that became manifest in mankind is not just, it's not trivial, it's not apple stealing. It's more significant than that. It's a rebellion against God. And this rebelliousness within man can reach a point where it drives him to do senseless, heinous evil, where Cain actually kills his brother for no good reason at all. And what we're going to see now is that although this evil has become manifest in man, it is not all pervasive. There are some who do not are not in the same situation as Cain, who are outright rebels. Let's look at the end of Genesis 4, the last two verses. And Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. And to Seth, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So at the very end of chapter 4, we have this counterbalance to what we've just seen described with respect to Cain. Cain acted in outright rebellion against God and was defiant and arrogant even after having been confronted with his evil. And furthermore, his offspring then seemed to demonstrate the same kind of arrogance and rebelliousness towards God. So we have a whole clan, we have a whole line of descent from Adam that seems to be characterized by this rebelliousness. But we have another line of descent from Adam, and it seems to be different, have a different spirit. Seth was born to Adam and Eve following the death of Abel. Seth means appointed. So Seth was the appointed replacement for Abel. And it says that Eve said, God has appointed me another offspring, another seed. Now the term seed in Genesis, I'm convinced, is a significant term. It doesn't just mean someone who has been born to me. Seed is a loaded term, and it means the one who inherits the spiritual blessings of the Father. That consistently through Genesis we will see that the one who is referred to as the seed of the Father is the one who inherits, starting with Abraham, inherits the blessings that God made to the Father. So it becomes a very significant term. It means that they have. This is someone who has inherited, who shares the Father's disposition towards God and inherits those blessings. And I think that that's the meaning that we have here, that Seth shares the same disposition towards God that Adam has, and is the, and in that sense is the seed. Cain is never referred to as the seed of Adam. Then Seth has a child, and he names his child Enosh. It's not clear exactly what Enosh means, but it means man, but it has the connotation of man in his frailty, man in his vulnerability and his mortality. If that's true, that's interesting. Abel, remember, meant vanity. We have not really flattering names here, but there's a sense in which to call your son Enosh is a good sign. That what Seth and those like him have realized is that man is not good God material. Man is indeed a frail being, a mortal, a dependent being, and cannot be otherwise. And then it follows with this last sentence, then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So it's at this time, then, that man begins to call upon the name of the Lord. What does it mean when it says to call upon the name of the Lord? When I was in college, there were probably a record number of strange religious groups. And I was going to school in Seattle, and Seattle, I think, was the capital of strange religious groups. There was one religious group that my roommate liked to go to these and find out what they were like. One of them, they said they preached that if you chanted Nam Myoho Renge Kyo, I don't even have any idea what it means. I don't even know what language it's in. But if you were to chant that, you could get whatever you chanted for, whatever you had in mind that you wanted. And they would have these meetings where people would get together and talk about all the things that they had gotten by chanting this Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. There was another group, though, that came to mind in reading this. And they preached that if you were to chant, Oh Lord Jesus, we'd all get together and chant this, then you would be saved. You get salvation. So they would get together once a week, and they would all chant together for 15 or 20 minutes. Oh, Lord Jesus. I don't think that's what it means here. But it is helpful, I think. This does have meaning. It is worth thinking about. What does this mean? Rather than just putting content into it that we dream up ourselves. What does it mean to call upon the name of the Lord? Let me go back and try to describe the predicament that they're in, what they can know and how they can know it, and therefore what he might mean by they began to call upon the name of the Lord. If you'll recall, the problem began when Adam and Eve ate from the fruit that God had said, do not eat from it. In doing that, in performing that act, what they were doing is they were saying, I am in a better position to choose my course of life. I am in a better position to run my life than God is. It is, after all, my life. I'm going to take control of it. I'm going to decide for myself what I will do and what I will not do. And in that sense, they became like gods. They took control of their own lives. They became their own masters. The problem is, man was not made to be a god. Man was made a creature, not a creator. And for him to be a god is disastrous. For him to be a god is against his whole purpose, against his whole makeup. God mercifully then put man in a position where it would become apparent to him that he is not a good God, that he's not capable of running his own life. And the way he did that is he injected into our experience futility. Or another way of saying that, he withdrew his grace. As a result then, after Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, the experience of mankind is constantly one of frustration and futility, because God built into us certain desires, certain longings, certain needs. And apart from God, we can't fulfill those. We can't meet those needs. We can't get satisfaction. We can't get fulfillment. And God withdrew his grace, guaranteeing that we would not be able to get that kind of fulfillment and satisfaction. And that's the death that they experienced the day that they ate of the fruit. That futility and frustration became an everyday experience in their life. Ultimately, then, that frustration and futility culminates in physical death. So physical death is just a part of that whole package. We are all eventually, sometime, going to face into the ultimate futility, and that is, we are going to die. We will cease to exist as human beings. And for people, for beings that would like to be gods, that's particularly vexing. To not even have control over your own existence. So death is just the culmination. Physical death is just the culmination of that frustration and futility that God plunged us into. So as someone like Seth or Enosh is looking at their situation, what they see is every aspect of their life is tainted with this kind of Midas touch. Everything he touches turns to not gold, but rust. Everything falls apart. Relationships, work is frustrating. Everything is frustrating and futile. No matter how hard they try to make it otherwise, that's all their experience is. So how do we deal with this existence of death, where everything is frustrating, futile, and we're going to die? Someone like Seth or Enosh would look around and say, I can't do it. I can't get the things that I need to get to be fulfilled. I just can't bring that about. Is there any hope? Well, there is hope. There are signs that God is a merciful God. If you remember back at the time that Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, God came looking for them, even though he knew that they had done it. In the punishment that he proclaimed, there were suggestions that this evil is going to be done away with. Furthermore, God made permanent clothing for man, for Adam and Eve. He didn't have to do that. God was merciful towards Cain. Despite Cain's rebelliousness, God was merciful towards him. So someone like Seth or Enosh can look back at the history and say, God is a God who insists on our obedience. But in the face of rebelliousness, he is still a merciful and forgiving God. And as a result, someone like Seth could conclude, if there is any hope for life, it's going to come from that same God. And if there's any hope for life, it's going to come on his terms, not mine. And I think that that's what it means when it said, man began to call upon the name of the Lord. It is, man began to look to God, some men, began to look to God for salvation from this futility and death that they have been immersed in. There's a psalm that I'd like to read, Psalm 116, in which this expression, call upon the name of the Lord, appears three times. This psalm, it's not known who wrote it, but apparently the author was spared from death, some deadly situation. Someone was plotting to kill him. And he called out to God, and God spared him. So there are three times when it mentions here that the author called upon the name of the Lord. The first time, it's for help in saving him from this plot against him. And the other times, it is in thankfulness for God's salvation. Let me read through this. I love the Lord because he hears my voice and my supplications, because he has inclined his ear to me. Therefore I shall call upon him as long as I live. The cords of death encompassed me, and the terrors of Sheol came upon me. I found distress and sorrow. Then I called upon the name of the Lord. O Lord, I beseech thee, save my life. Gracious is the Lord and righteous. Yes, our God is compassionate. The Lord preserves the simple. I was brought low, and he saved me. Return to your rest, O my soul, for the Lord has dealt bountifully with you. For thou hast rescued my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I shall walk before the Lord in the land of the living. I believed when I said, I am greatly afflicted. And I said in my alarm, all men are liars. What shall I render to the Lord for all his benefits toward me? I shall lift up the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. I shall pay my vows to the Lord. Oh, may it be in the presence of all his people. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his godly ones. O Lord, surely I am thy servant. I am thy servant, the son of thy handmaid. Thou hast loosed my bonds. To thee I shall offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving and call upon the name of the Lord. I shall pay my vows to the Lord. Oh, may it be in the presence of all his people, in the courts of the Lord's house, in the midst of you, O Jerusalem, praise the Lord. Clearly here, in this psalm, when he talks about calling upon the name of the Lord, there are two parts to it. One is appealing to God for God's deliverance, and the other is an attitude of gratitude or thankfulness to God for what he has done. Both of those seem to be intertwined in the concept of calling upon the name of the Lord. So I suspect that that's what it means here in Genesis. That's what fits. That what men have begun to do, at least a portion of mankind, has seen the futility and frustration of their situation, and they have looked to God for salvation from it. They may not know the details of how that would happen. In fact, they probably did not. But they know that there's only one place that they can go for the salvation that they need, and they're looking in that direction. Okay, so that is a counterbalance then to Cain. Not everyone is like a descendant of Cain. There is another line of descent that comes from Adam, a family that's characterized by a different spirit. Chapter 5 then goes through and lists the descendants of Adam through Seth, and it takes us to Noah. I will read through this. It's long, and it's genealogy, but I'll read it anyway. There are a couple of things then that I'll point out. This is the book of generations of Adam in the day when God created man. He made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. Then the days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And Seth lived 105 years and became the father of Enosh. Then Seth lived 807 years after he became the father of Enosh, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. And Enosh lived 90 years and became the father of Kenan. Then Enosh lived 815 years after he became the father of Kenan, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. And Kenan lived 70 years and became the father of Mahalalel. And then Kenan lived 840 years after he became the father of Mahalalel, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Kenan were 910 years, and he died. And Mahalalel lived 65 years and became the father of Jared. Then Mahalalel lived 830 years after he became the father of Jared, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years, and he died. And Jared lived 162 years and became the father of Enoch. Then Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. And Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And Methuselah lived 187 years and became the father of Lamech. Then Methuselah lived 782 years after he became the father of Lamech, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. And Lamech lived 182 years and became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah, saying, "This one shall give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed." Then Lamech lived 595 years after he became the father of Noah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. There are a few things that I would like to comment on in this section. Notice that having talked about what happened in the Garden of Eden with the fall, and then talking about Cain and Cain's descendants, now we're going to kind of start over now and talk about this line of descent through Seth. So it talks about even the Adam coming into being, that Adam was created in the likeness of God, it reminds us. And what I argued earlier is that what it means when it says that Adam was created in the likeness of God is that Adam was created a moral being capable of reflecting the moral character of God. And he came with all of the attributes that are necessary to be able to be a good moral being. That is, But Adam, it was not only a good he was not only capable of reflecting the moral character of God. I think that there are indications that Adam was in fact repentant for the evil that he had done. So he was well disposed towards God as well. So both are true. Seth then is his seed and the one who has that same disposition towards God, shares that repentance for his rebelliousness. And in that sense then, it says that Seth was in the image and likeness of Adam. So it's setting up here this line of descent in their spiritual disposition. We have virtually no details about any of these people until we get down to Enoch. If you recall back to the descendants of Cain, anything that was said with respect to a descendant of Cain was either bad or it talked about their innovative innovations in this world, what they created, what they made. In this line of descent, the only comments we have are with respect to Enoch and Noah, and in both cases they are positive things, clearly positive things. With respect to Enoch, it says that he walked with God. We will see in the next chapter that this phrase is also used with respect to Noah, about whom it says that Noah was righteous and blameless. So to walk with God seems to mean having that kind of spirit that wants to be obedient. It is the opposite of the spirit of rebelliousness that we see in the descendants of Cain. It is the spirit of repentance and the spirit of obedience, the desire to be obedient. Enoch walked with God, and it says he was not. So Enoch does not die. We don't see the word die being used with Enoch, which really stands out. He just ceased to be among men. Now, what happened there, I don't know. It is a curious and not highly elaborated upon statement. We do have record of one other human being who departed from this earth but did not die, and that was Elijah, who was taken up in a chariot of fire. The other person in this line of descent that receives some comment is Noah. The word Noah means comfort. And he was named that because, it says, "This one shall give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed." That is, there's a recognition on the part of his father Lamech that life is futile. You plant crops and what come up are weeds. That constantly we run into obstacles and frustrations. And he names his son Noah, saying he will give us rest or comfort from this curse that God has placed on nature, on the earth. Apparently, Lamech has heard and has remembered the proclamations that were made by God when he proclaimed the punishment on the serpent and Adam and on Eve. We saw earlier that Adam and Eve took the statement that God had made when he said that her seed, that is the seed of the woman, will crush the seed, crush the head of the seed of the serpent. They apparently took that to heart as something that was very hopeful, a promise that they could cling to, that evil would be destroyed sometime. And apparently, that promise was remembered. And now we get to the time of Noah, and Lamech is looking to Noah then as the one who will be that deliverer. So he has hope then that that promise will be realized and will be realized in his son. So in this line of descent, it seems to be characterized by a different spirit. It is characterized by a spirit of humility and obedience as opposed to the line of Cain, which is characterized by arrogance and rebelliousness. Okay, before we get into chapter 6, there are a couple of little... I want to respond to a couple of questions that probably come to your mind or have come to your mind at some point when you've read through this section. We have this genealogical data that tells us when each father had their son, and how long they lived. And by putting together all of the genealogical data, we should be able to build back and figure out the date when Adam lived. And anybody could do that. And it comes out to 4004. It was done by the Bishop of Usher in the Middle Ages. That was the first time that it was, it's credited to him having compiled all this stuff. 4004 BC then would be the day when Adam was made. Now, as you're all probably aware, that does not accord well with radiocarbon dating of humanoid type bones that have been found. In fact, it's way off. Most of the books about primitive man say that man as we know him, man indistinguishable from us, appears at about 40,000 BC. So there's a discrepancy here. I don't know that I trust the dating methods of our scientists. But 4004 BC does seem quite recent. It's difficult to fit in what we do know about the past into the little time that is there. It is possible that these genealogies are not complete. We don't have every generation listed. It was common in ancient times to have abbreviated genealogies in which generations were skipped. For instance, in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew, we know for a fact that in Matthew 1:8, Joram, I think it is said to be the father of, and I can't remember who it says, but we know that he is the great-grandson of Joram. Two generations are skipped in that genealogy. We know that from the Old Testament data. So it was ancient practice to skip generations. Furthermore, we have 10 generations before the flood, and then we have 10 generations between the flood and Adam. Abraham, between the flood and Abraham. And the symmetry is interesting and suspicious. It could be that there were just 10 generations before and 10 generations after, but it could also be something more artificial, that there's selectivity going on in the presentation of the genealogies. Furthermore, Derek Kidner, in his commentary on Genesis, cites an article in which the evidence is laid out for genealogies being done in the ancient Near East, in which we have not only generations being skipped, but we have the same kind of year data given. That is, the number of years until a child was born, who later produced the child whose name is mentioned in the genealogy. You see what I'm saying there? That actually did, there is precedence for that happening. If that's the case, if generations have been skipped, we cannot then reconstruct the day when Adam was born, because we don't know how much was skipped. So if that's the case, then we cannot build up with an absolute chronology, build back to when these people lived. And if that's the case, we don't know. It could be thousands of years. It could be, we don't know. Okay. The other question, did they really live so long? Did they really live 1,000 years? If you look at the kings lists of the ancient cultures, of Sumer, of Babylon, of Assyria, it is interesting that all of the earliest, the kings at the beginning of the lists, the number of years that they live is in the tens of thousands. And as you get closer to the present, the number of years that they live drop off dramatically. It could be that those kings' lists are remembering something that is true and something that is preserved by the Old Testament, and that is that people did indeed live much longer than they do now. When we get into our discussion of the flood, I think that there are a number of indications in the text that the flood was an earth-changing event. It dramatically changed the environment of the earth, such that it may be possible that man lived longer before the flood and lives a much shorter time after the flood. That things so the environment changed so dramatically that it became that we could not live to those same kinds of years. And, as we'll see in the beginning of chapter 6, I think that's what it's suggesting that God wanted to accomplish with the flood. So we'll look at that. So, I think that these ages that are recorded here are accurate, that we do indeed have an accurate presentation of the fact that people lived longer before the flood. Okay, now we're going to look at a strange passage. We'll look at the first 8 verses of chapter 6. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Okay. This passage is sometimes interpreted to be a description of fallen angels who come down to earth and have sexual relations with human women, and they then give birth to this breed of giants called the Nephilim. And much of the reason for that interpretation is because the sons of God, that expression is used in Job quite clearly to refer to angels. So that's the main force driving that particular interpretation. I don't think that it should be interpreted that way, but you need to understand why I'm arguing that it shouldn't. I'm convinced that Moses, the author of Genesis, is a good storyteller. I don't mean that in the sense that he's making up a story. He's telling history, but history is a story. And history told properly all fits together. You don't have loose ends, even in history. If you have loose ends, it's not well told. And I'm convinced that Moses is a competent storyteller and that he's not going to have loose ends. If I have understood the first five chapters of Genesis correctly, by the time we get to chapter 6, we've got a real problem. If I've understood it correctly, what he's describing is how evil became spread throughout mankind, and how evil it became, how clearly evil it manifested itself to be. And the descendants of Cain are characterized by this evil and this rebellion and this arrogance. However, there is another line of descent from Adam which is not characterized by this rebelliousness and this arrogance. That in this other line, there is a spirit of repentance and a spirit of obedience. When we get to verse 5 of chapter 6, it says, Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And he decides to wipe out all of mankind, and plus the animals. And there's only one person who is righteous, and that's Noah. So the question is, what happened to the line of descent that was characterized by obedience? And if you're following the story through, that's your question when you get to the beginning of chapter 6. So these first few verses of chapter 6 have to be answering that question. Otherwise, we've got loose ends. So it's on that reasoning, then, that I'm taking this in a different direction. That the sons of God must be a reference to those who have been obedient and faithful with respect to God. And what's happened? What's happened is mankind has proliferated on the earth. And daughters are being born to the man, to the fathers. And mankind looks out and he sees that they are beautiful. And this is the sons of God are are looking out and seeing that the daughters of men are beautiful also. And they took wives for themselves whomever they chose. So they see that they are beautiful, and they take wives on that basis. Can they be condemned for selecting wives because they're beautiful? Well, there's a sense in which that's rather innocent, but there's a sense in which that's very significant that it's not innocent at all. Think about what marriage is. Marriage is the merging of two lives in the most intimate relationship that is possible in human existence. On what basis would you choose a spouse, given that your spouse is going to be the closest relationship you've got in your life? You tell me the basis on which you will make that decision, and I will tell you what's important to you. That's guaranteed. Because what's most important to you is the thing that you're going to look for. That's really a critical decision. And it's very telling of what you hold to be valuable and what you hold not to be valuable. So it seems trivial, but I think, in fact, it's very telling. And it's telling of a value, the values that they hold, they have compromised those values. And God's response is, my spirit will not strive, it will not be patient with man forever, because he also is flesh. He's just mortal. I'm not going to put up with him forever. Verse 3, I would, instead of nevertheless, the marginal translation is therefore, I think I would go with therefore. Therefore his days will be 120 years. God's response to this is to say, I am going to face man into his mortality much sooner. Think about it. If you lived 1,000 years, how would you live life? Think about how you think about death. When does death become a reality in your life? The only time it's a reality is when a friend or relative dies, or you get to the age where you expect to die. But before then, is death a reality? I mean, how many of us live as though we're going to die? How many of us really think about death? And yet we know that by the time we're 120 or less, we're going to be dead. What if people were living to 1,000? When would you think about death? When would you think about the fact that you're mortal? When you're 950? So what God's response to man's arrogance is going to be to face him into death much sooner, to shorten lifespans. So rather than being something like 1,000 years, it's going to be something like 120. Then how would I fit the Nephilim into this? That's difficult. My guess is that Moses is expecting that they have more information about the Nephilim than we do. The Nephilim are giants. They are referred to in one other place in Scripture. The Nephilim and the Rephaim. And I think that Moses is just using this as to pinpoint the time period. This is the time period in which the Nephilim lived. And I would assume that they were rather notorious and would have been known to the readers. But other than that, I don't know how to account for these two verses. Okay, so that's why I'm interpreting it the way that I am. Because that's what makes sense of the whole flow of thought in this section in Genesis. So what has happened is even in the line of descent that has been characterized by obedience and faithfulness to God, they too have compromised. They too have capitulated. And as a result, wickedness is spread throughout mankind, such that he says in verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. It couldn't be a more categorical statement. That's incredible. But all that's being demonstrated, all that's visible when God looks down at mankind, is constant wickedness, constant evil. And I assume that what that means is rebelliousness against God. So God is sorry that he has made man. And he decides that what he's going to do is wipe out mankind, completely destroy them. And not only is he going to wipe out man, but he's going to wipe out all of the animals. All of the animals, creeping things, birds in the sky. Because he's sorry that he had made man. But, it says, Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And as we will see as we progress through this, that Noah and his family will be spared. They will be the sole humans that are spared from this judgment. So these first 5.5 chapters of Genesis paint a really disturbing picture of the nature of the evil, the rebelliousness that is in us. To think that it started with eating an apple that they were told not to eat. It seems so innocent, and yet there's a sense in which it is a heinous evil. And we see that being manifested in Cain, in which the evil overcomes him to such an extent that he goes crazy. He's a madman. And he does things that make no sense. And this evil is of such a nature that it's creeping. And it infects one person after another and corrupts the sense of obedience and faithfulness that is manifested even in the line of Seth, such that they compromise and sell out. And God then, looking down upon this, decides, I'm going to wipe out the whole bunch. It spares only Noah. Sobering picture. The way really is narrow. There really are few that find their way to God. And that stay the course. And we live in a time in which evil, I think, is more pronounced than it may have been in some past years. But it is also, it's more pronounced, but it is a huge influence on us. And there is a sense in which we really need one another to help us to stay the course. We need each other to be watching out for us and to be helping us to see when we're compromising. Because it's in rather innocent looking compromises that evil makes its inroads and eats away at our souls. It is only going to be with the help of others and by the grace of God that any of us will escape the wickedness that's so prevalent and out there. Okay, questions, comments?
This so happens, wandered into a field of expertise for us. We've done research on creation science, on the carbon dating. Carbon dating, the fundamental problem is the carbon-14 takes a certain amount, I think like 10,000 years or so to reach equilibrium. And then the scientists start off with the assumption that the Earth is millions of years old, so we're already at equilibrium. So if you throw in the correction factor for not being at equilibrium, then you get much different dates, because the further back in time, it gets exponentially worse. So carbon dating is accurate if you take in the right account. And then on the pre-flood environment of Earth, they're pretty sure it was much different. There was like a water canopy around the Earth, which would protect us from like radiation from the sun and other sources. And it would also increase the atmospheric pressure a few times. And if you take this into account, then that explains how like pterodons and pterodactyls could fly, because they couldn't fly in our current atmosphere. And then the ancient plant life, at that time, plants were being watered. There was like a layer of water beneath the crust of the Earth, and the water would come up, from below and come up to water the plants. And it would bring along all sorts of minerals and stuff, because they've discovered in ancient plant life there was like a lot more minerals, per plant. So what people were eating then was, had a lot more minerals and nutrients in it. So all these things would combine to extend the average life of humans. And also scientists have mentioned that we only use 10% of our brains. Well, if we only live, if we lived 1,000 years and now we only live 100 years, that's 1/10. So that kind of follows along there. But there's, and the one theory about the flood I like the best, basically it comes down to, we made God mad and he threw a big snowball at us. And the earth to this day wobbles a little on its axis, as if something, hit the earth, froze a bunch of mammoths up north, froze them instantly, cracked the thin crust of the earth, which let the water that was below come out in fountains, and caused the water canopy to condense, which dropped the atmospheric pressure. All these fit pretty nicely in. If there's a lot of information which would take hours, but that's it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And I think you wanted to.
I'm aware of some of the details with respect to carbon dating. I know that they are trying to correlate carbon dating with tree ring dating, where they have been able to come up with tree ring sequences that go back, way back into, I think they've got it back to about 8,000 B.C., I've got the tree ring chronology sequences back that far in Turkey. And as a result, they've been able to correspond tree ring dating with carbon-14 dating, and they've come up with a graph whereby they correct the carbon-14 dating so that it lines up with the information they have from tree ring dating. This stuff is all very complicated. My concern is that the scientists who are working on it, on both sides, oftentimes have an agenda. And certainly on the part of the secular scientists, they have I don't know if it's as much of an agenda as it is a set of assumptions. And their set of assumptions are really firmly in their thinking, and it affects how they interpret the data that they see. They're expecting big numbers. So what do they find? They find big numbers. I would really like to see someone get in and sort that stuff out that that is a little more open-minded. Because what I see on the other side is scientists who are not very good exegetes, who come to certain conclusions about what the Bible must be saying, and then they go look at the scientific data and have a tendency to interpret it through that. What we really need is someone to look at all this stuff with a little more flexibility in thinking about these things and see if they could make it all fit together, because I'm sure it would if that were done.
I wanted to make two comments. One is, you were talking about how Seth, at the time of him, people became to call in the name of the Lord, and you were talking about how there's all this futility out there that they experienced everywhere. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that it wasn't just outside of them that they were experienced, it was in the context of their own choices and how that played itself out in relationships and how they saw themselves treating people and being treated and that well as well, their own sin. And I was thinking that you also, secondly, you drew a really helpful picture of God's response to Adam and Eve's sin and Cain's sin. And I was thinking that even in this shortening of life for us and facing us into our mortality, is actually a picture of God's grace and mercy as well, because it really faces us in more quickly into what's true.
Yes. Yes, definitely. That's one of the things that's been so striking to me as I've looked through Genesis just over the last few weeks. You frequently hear the God of the Old Testament being contrasted with the God of the New Testament. That the God of the Old Testament is the God of wrath and judgment. But that's not what we're seeing here in Genesis. I mean, at every turn, we see God being forgiving and acting in a way that's really very gracious. He could have just zapped people at every turn. That's not what we see happening.
I know you were saying that.
And in fact, what is particularly gracious about it is it's those struggles that we have in life that give us the context to figure out how our heart is actually inclined. do we act in faith or do we act in rebelliousness? Do we say, I've had it, I'm going to do what I want to do? So those, it's that futility that's in our life that is a constant opportunity for us to see what we really value and what we don't value, where we stand. Yes, exactly, exactly.
I don't know how much more you can say about this, but I was kind of surprised how quickly you passed over Enoch. And I know there's not a lot there, but I would really be interested in hearing your thoughts on him and whatnot.
I don't know what to say. There's so little there. It is striking that we would have a human being who is, in a sense, so privileged that he is honored with being taken without dying. But other than that, I really don't know what to say. Do you have ideas?
I guess I'm wondering what that might have looked like for him to be Shabbat, given that he was a singer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really.
I mean, it's kind of a model. I mean, what Denise is asking you to do is what the author of Hebrews did. He says, by faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God took him up, for he obtained the witness before his being taken up. He was pleasing to God, and without faith is it impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. If I understand what the author of Hebrews is doing, he's basically saying, I'm giving you a list of people who had faith in the Old Testament. And Enoch is one of them. And how do I know he had faith? Because God was pleased with him and took him up so he didn't see death. And without faith, it's impossible to please God. So he must have been a person with faith. I mean, that doesn't say anything about him having faith. It says he walked with God. But the author of Hebrews is basically saying, well, that must have been the kind of person he was. So the question of what it would look like, I mean, his model is not one of perfect righteousness so much as believing in God and something like that.
I guess the problem with that for me is that I think there are two people who got taken up, you know, and if Enoch, if the reason he did not see death was because of his faith, what does that say for the rest of us? You know, I mean, it's but more seriously, for those folks back then, I mean, God, I think, commented on the faith of many. Noah, David, they saw death. So, what was it about Enoch that was so special? I mean, it's just really disturbingly curious.
God could have done that with others. He just chose to select out Enoch. But I think that there were others who had faith. And I think when it says man began to call upon the name of the Lord, those who call upon the name of the Lord, I think, are the same ones as those who walk with God. Those are essentially the same, describing the same thing, the same disposition of heart and spirit. That it's those who see that salvation from this death can only come from God and on God's terms. That's what it means, I think, to walk with God, and that's what it means, I think, to call upon the name of the Lord.
You mentioned just a little bit today about it, but mostly last week, and I've been thinking about it. You mentioned a line of people that were faithless and all the way down, and they were the innovators and the craftsmen and the builders. And I don't understand that. I don't understand how how their disbelief got labeled onto their ability to build.
Well,
does that make sense what I'm asking?
It makes sense. Let me answer it, and you can tell me whether I made the right sense of it. What we see in the descent of Cain is it's a line of descent that's characterized by arrogance and rebelliousness. Within that description, it has three people who are fathers of some kind of human activity. And in each of those, and we also have Cain building the first city. He's building the first city because he doesn't trust God to protect him. He's going to protect himself. So all of these steps towards civilization are being taken by a group of people that is characterized by rebelliousness and arrogance. Why would they be innovative? Well, there are lots of things that we could talk about here, but I think it is very interesting that we have the Middle Ages ending with the Renaissance. And what happens in the Renaissance is the medieval worldview all breaks down. And part of the medieval view, a really central part of it, is that we are here in life and this is a temporary state. And I should expect it to be hard, and my job is to cope with it and to do what God wants me to do here, because I will soon be dead and I'm going to another life. That worldview broke down. And in the Renaissance, people became interested in what we can do here in this life and began to concentrate on that. And as people began to concentrate on what we can accomplish here in this life, they made great strides, many innovations and developments, technological as well as artistic. In other words, they had thrown their energies into the sphere of things in this world, making things better here. And if you devote yourself to making things better here, you will make better widgets. You're going to make better things. And I think that's what's being pictured there. That they became involved, heavily involved, in life here in this world, and therefore they became the leading innovators. I've often thought about, generally speaking, what is the kind of person that makes a lot of money? Generally speaking, the kind of person that makes a lot of money is one for whom a lot of money is important. It's not always the case, but that's generally the case. That if you make that your top priority, you'll do well at it. You'll do better than the one who doesn't. So if you make life in this world your top priority, you'll be more innovative. You'll discover more things because that's where your all of your energy is going. That's all, where all you think about. That's all that you're working on. But if your priorities are elsewhere, you're less likely to be a leading innovator in this world. So I think that's what's being described there. They did well because they had invested their everything in here, in this world.
So building on an addition to a already livable home, still at the end of your day, you have to say, this could be gone in a blink. I don't know. Those kind of things I just struggle with because it's like, okay, from the very beginning, they were doing that and we're still doing it. How much are we blind to of what we're doing that is so wrong?
Well, that
and we could be living in a tent. We'd get a little wet, but, you know, we're so comfortable and continue to make ourselves more comfortable. But I guess from what I'm hearing is those people never asked or were aware of any other question than progressing ahead. Is that what?
For them, the priority was stuff here. And since their priority was stuff here, they did well with respect to stuff here. It was the highest priority for them. We all have to ask ourselves the question, very frequently, I think, what do I really value? I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with building on an addition. But we still have to ask ourselves the question often and seriously, what do I really value? Because to make as a top priority our comfort in this life here is a fatal error. And we need to avoid it at all costs.
Sort of following up on Miffy's question, I think I feel torn because there's parts of me that, you know, I wouldn't want to live in the Middle Ages. And with the type of music and art and things like that we really enjoy and get into, at the same time I recognize the people that are tops in their profession are ones, they have no other life. I mean, they've sold all for that, whether that's sports or right. business or music or whatever it is. But how do we struggle? I mean, it seems like we struggle trying to value what's important, but nevertheless still wanting those other things because they do kind of inspire us and whether it's watching good movies or right. that type of thing.
Right. There's nothing wrong with those other things inherently, but we have to understand that ultimately they're neither here nor there. If you have them, fine. If you don't have them, that's fine too. That's equally fine. In fact, that may be better at times. The question is, what do we value? And I think that we will struggle with that question all of our life. The question will be posed slightly differently every day. But the question's going to keep coming back. And it's a good question. And the question is, what do we value? When it comes down to it, deep down in our soul, what do we value? And we can only answer that. I mean, we have to answer that as honestly as we possibly can. And ultimately, the way we answer that is we say, what have I done? When it's come to those critical points where I had to choose between two things, which did I choose? Because what I chose is going to tell me what I really value. And so it's those day-to-day kinds of situations and choices that we make that are a constant indicator of what we value. Just as a mundane example, if someone comes to me and says, I really value I won't come up with a good example, but tell me something that you value. And the way I can check is to have you hand me your checkbook. Because your checkbook is a record of how you have actually acted with respect to what you value. Our spending dollars, we spend dollars according to what we value. We're constantly weighing things. I will pay $10 for this, but I will not spend $10 for that. Well, then I must value that more than this. Similarly, our lives, as we go through our life, on our day-to-day basis, what did I choose, given a choice between two things? What did I choose? Well, those choices tell you what you value. I think if I've used as an example before the family that I worked with in Paris, where I took care of their kids. Those parents would have said that they valued their children dearly. But I would say, well, show us the checkbook. Now, I'm not talking about dollars here. I'm talking about how did you spend something more valuable? That is, how did you spend your time with respect to those kids? And the way they actually spent their time with respect to those kids was not much. And I would say on that basis, you don't value your kids. You can say you value your kids till you're blue in the face, but until you act as though you value the kids, you don't value your kids. So every day we are making choices. And you can tell from the choices you make what you value. And that is good feedback and something that we need to keep into account, take into account in figuring out where our heart really is. It tells us where our heart is. And to the extent that we are valuing the wrong things, we need to beg for God's forgiveness and ask for His strength to see things rightly, to reevaluate. Okay, we need to, for the sake of the people watching the kids, we're done.